Hello, this is Sue Lloyd, a member of the International Accounting Standards Board. I'm joined today by two members of the Financial Instruments team, Rhianna Wiesner and Tiernan Ketchum. What we want to do today is to provide you with an overview of IFRS 9, the final version that we published last week. The main focus of today's presentation will be on aspects of IFRS 9 that changed in the final publications. After we've finished the presentation, there'll be an opportunity for you to ask us some questions at the end. A copy of this webcast will be posted on our website later today, and this afternoon we will run another session of this webcast. As always, the views expressed in the webcast are the personal views of those who are presenting. As I said, last week we published the final and completed version of IFRS 9. This document brings together all of the phases of the project, classification and measurement, impairment and hedge accounting, and completes the ISB's project to replace IAS 39. The ISB has previously published versions of IFRS 9, but this 2014 publication is the final version of the standard and replaces earlier versions of IFRS 9. This webcast, as I said, will cover each part of IFRS 9, but since there have been no changes to the hedge accounting model published in 2013, we will mainly focus on the limited amendments to the classification and measurement requirements and the new impairment model in IFRS 9. With that, I'll hand over to Tiernan.
Thank you, Sue. Well, we'll begin with classification and measurement. IFRS 9 changes classification and measurement by introducing a logical structure to how financial assets are classified. Consistent with the previous versions of IFRS 9, this completed version uses a principle-based approach for classifying financial assets that's designed to provide useful and relevant information to users of financial statements about the timing, amounts, and uncertainty of future cash flows. This approach classifies financial assets in their entirety, hence, there is no longer bifurcation of assets. The two criteria used to do this are whether the asset's contractual cash flows are solely payments of principal and interest, and what the objective of the business model is within which the financial assets are held, that focuses on how cash flows will be collected. The main change introduced by the limited amendments to the classification and measurement requirement for financial assets is the introduction of an additional element within the classification structure for simple debt instruments that meet the contractual cash flow characteristics criterion. So, for simple debt instruments, that is a fair value through other comprehensive income measurement category that is based on the business model within which the financial assets are managed. For the amortized cost measurement category, only the collection of contractual cash flows is integral to achieving the objective of the business model. However, the fair value through other comprehensive income measurement category represents a business model where both the collection of contractual cash flows and the realization of cash flows through sales are integral to achieve that objective. The objective of such a business model could be, for example, to manage liquidity, maintain a particular interest yield profile, or match the duration of financial liabilities to the duration of the assets they are funding. The fair value through other comprehensive income measurement category results in amortized cost information being provided in profit or loss, and fair value information being provided on the balance sheet. In the comment letters received in response to the limited amendments ED published in 2012, respondents asked for more guidance on how an entity should distinguish between the three measurement categories and what information should be considered when making the business model assessment. As mentioned before, the limited amendments did not change the existing principles for classification and measurement in IFRS 9, but rather clarified the concept of the business model assessment and provided additional application guidance on how such an assessment should be made. It's now emphasized that the business model reflects how financial assets are managed to generate cash flows, that is, through the collection of contractual cash flows, selling financial assets, or both. The business model is typically evidenced through the activities that an entity undertakes to achieve its business objective and the way in which the entity manages the risks that its financial assets are exposed to. The business model is not simply an assertion. It's a matter of fact that is evidenced through information such as business plans, how managers of the business are compensated, and the amount and frequency of sales activity and the reasons for those sales. An entity's selling activity is relevant to the assessment, but selling in itself is not determinative of the business model. When considering past sales activity, an entity should consider not only the volume or frequency of the sales, but also the reasons that the sales were made. IFRS 9 makes clear that the selling of financial assets when credit risk has increased is consistent with the objective of the hold-to-collect business model. When assessing the business model, an entity is expected to take into consideration its expectations about how financial assets will be managed in the future and the objective it wants to achieve. However, an entity need not consider a worst-case scenario or scenarios that it does not reasonably expect to occur. In order to be measured at amortized cost or at fair value through other comprehensive income, the asset's contractual cash flows must be solely payments of principal and interest. In other words, the contractual cash flows must be simple and consistent with a basic lending arrangement. The objective of this requirement is to identify those instruments for which the effective interest method, which simply allocates interest over the life of a financial instrument, results in useful and relevant information. And as mentioned in a previous slide, when an asset is measured at fair value through other comprehensive income, amortized cost information is recognized in profit or loss. So this cash flow assessment is relevant for both amortized cost and for fair value through other comprehensive income. Often it will be readily apparent whether the asset's contractual cash flows are solely payments of principal and interest. But since the publication of the first version of IFRS 9 in 2009, interested parties have asked the ISB for additional guidance on how to make that assessment for particular financial assets. The ISB, therefore, has made some clarifications to this assessment to better align it with what are commonly viewed as simple instruments or a basic lending arrangement. The completed version of IFRS 9 hence provides additional application guidance. In particular, IFRS 9 now clarifies that usually consideration for time value of money and credit risk are the most significant elements of interest, but those may not be the only elements. Consistent with a basic lending arrangement, interest may also include compensation for risks such as liquidity risk and costs associated with holding the asset, as well as a profit margin. Now, the time value of money element of interest provides consideration only for the passage of time, absent a return for other risks or costs. In some cases, however, the time value of money element might not be perfect. IFRS 9 describes this as a modified time value of money element. An example is where a contractual feature sets the interest rate on an asset by reference to an average of short and long-term rates. In such a case, the asset can still qualify for measurement at amortized cost or fair value through other comprehensive income, as long as the effect of the modification cannot result in cash flows that are significantly different from perfect cash flows. These perfect cash flows are described as benchmark cash flows. An entity can make this assessment either qualitatively or quantitatively. The ISB also acknowledged that in some jurisdictions, the government or regulatory authority establishes interest rates, and in some cases, the objective of the time value of money element isn't to provide consideration for only the passage of time. The ISB decided that such a regulated rate is used as a proxy for the time value of money element as long as the interest rate does not provide exposure to risks or volatility that is inconsistent with a basic lending arrangement. Finally, IFRS 9 also clarifies what principal means. Principal is the fair value of the financial asset at initial recognition. Hence, it's the amount transferred by the current holder. During the development of IFRS 9, the ISB received feedback that the accounting requirements in IAS 39 for classifying and measuring financial liabilities worked well in practice. Because of this, IAS 39's treatment of financial liabilities was carried forward to IFRS 9 essentially unchanged. The only issue that the ISB was told needed urgent attention was the volatility in profit or loss caused by changes in the credit risk of financial liabilities that an entity has elected to measure at fair value under the fair value option. So, to understand this, note that the fair value of an entity's own debt is affected by changes in the entity's own credit risk. This means that when an entity's credit quality declines, the fair value of its liabilities fall, and if those liabilities are measured at fair value, a gain is recognized in profit or loss, and vice versa. Many investors and others found this result counterintuitive and confusing. IFRS 9 therefore introduces new requirements to address this so-called own credit issue. The liability is still carried in the balance sheet at full fair value, which users of financial statements confirmed as useful. But the effects of changes in own credit on the fair value of the liability are now presented in other comprehensive income rather than in profit or loss. So that discussion on financial liabilities and own credit concludes our bit on CNM. I'll pass it over now to Rihanna to talk about impairment.
Thank you, Tiernan. The impairment model in IFRS 9 is fundamentally the same as the model that was exposed in the 2013 impairment exposure draft. It is a deterioration model in which the extent to which credit risk has increased since initial recognition is reflected in the measurement of the loss allowance. This model is more forward-looking than the previous incurred loss model and more responsive to changes in credit risk. It also eliminates the threshold for the recognition of credit losses so that it is no longer necessary for a trigger event to have occurred before credit losses are recognized. The model in IFRS 9 requires an entity to recognize expected credit losses at all times and on all financial instruments within the scope of the model. For the general model, the loss allowance on financial instruments are measured at lifetime expected credit losses if there has been a significant increase in credit risk since initial recognition. All other financial instruments will have a loss allowance representing 12-month expected credit losses. The loss allowance should be updated at each reporting date to reflect changes in credit risk since initial recognition, even if those changes are not considered to be significant. Consequently, more timely information is provided about an entity's expectations about credit losses on its credit exposures at the reporting date. Information about changes in credit risk is also provided by the interest revenue recognition. Interest revenue is calculated based on the gross carrying amount of a financial asset, unless a financial asset becomes credit impaired subsequent to initial recognition. In that case, interest revenue is calculated on the net carrying amount, so the gross carrying amount reduced by the loss allowance, from the beginning of the next reporting period. This is similar to the accounting under IAS 39, and the indicators for when a financial asset is credit impaired are fundamentally the same as the indicators in IAS 39 for objective evidence of impairment. So this part of the model is not expected to result in changes to current practice. If we look at the scope for the impairment requirements, one of the main criticisms against IAS 39 was the multiple impairment models that apply to financial assets, where the relevant impairment model depended on the legal form of the asset, so in other words, whether it was a bond or a loan, or their classification. It was therefore possible for financial assets that were managed in the same way to achieve the same objective to have different impairment allowances just because they were classified differently. IFRS 9 eliminates this inconsistency by applying the same impairment model to all financial instruments that are within the scope of the requirements. The impairment model in IFRS 9 applies to all financial assets measured at amortized cost or fair value through other comprehensive income, lease receivables, and trade receivables and contract assets recognized in accordance with IFRS 15. If an entity applies IFRS 9 before it applies IFRS 15, the impairment model applies to trade receivables and construction contracts recognized in accordance with IAS 18 and IAS 11. Because the impairment model is based on expected credit losses that will result from an entity's exposure to credit risk, the model applies equally to off-balance sheet exposures, such as loan commitments and financial guarantee contracts that are not measured at fair value through profit or loss. This was done in response to feedback we received that on and off-balance sheet credit risk exposures are treated the same way using the same risk systems. This means that even if an entity has not yet recognized a financial asset resulting from these instruments, it will recognize a loss allowance for the expected credit losses associated with expected drawdowns over the contractual period that the entity is committed to provide the credit. Now, during the comment period and our subsequent outreach, one area of the impairment accounting that raised a lot of questions was the mechanics of the impairment requirements and the interaction of that with financial assets that were measured at fair value through profit and loss. Now, the fair value OCI category, as Tiernan mentioned, has been introduced to provide an amortized cost view in profit or loss and a fair value view in the balance sheet. So the impairment amount recognized in profit or loss is identical to that on an amortized cost asset. However, the balance sheet amount is fair value unadjusted for impairment. The difference in these two measurements is recognized through an entry to OCI. I want to focus on a couple of the key clarifications that were made to the proposals in the 2013 impairment exposure draft. And the most important of these was to improve the responsiveness of the model to changes in credit risk. Typically, credit risk increases significantly before a financial instrument becomes past due or another lagging borrower-specific factor is observed. However, depending on the nature of the financial instrument and the credit risk information available, an entity may not be able to identify significant increases in credit risk for individual financial instruments before they become past due. Based on the proposals in the 2013 exposure draft, many understood lifetime expected credit losses to only be recognized when an entity can identify individual financial instruments that have experienced a significant increase in credit risk since initial recognition. This was not the ISB's intention. The objective is to recognize lifetime expected credit losses for all significant increases in credit risk, whether on an individual or a collective basis. Application guidance and illustrative examples have been included in IFRS 9 on how to group financial instruments to capture significant increases in credit risk on a timely basis, such as by identifying sub-portfolios of financial instruments that are more likely to have experienced a significant increase in credit risk. Another key clarification included solutions to resolve operational concerns raised during the fieldwork. In order to assess significant increases in credit risk, IFRS 9 does not require the use of a mechanistic approach, for example, the use of explicit probabilities of defaults, or PDs. An entity may use any method or model to determine the changes in credit risk, as long as such a method considers the changes in the risk of a default occurring since initial recognition and the remaining time to maturity of the financial instrument. IFRS 9 also includes illustrative examples to demonstrate possible ways in which the requirements could be applied more simply, including the use of a counterparty credit risk assessment, provided that that meets the objectives of the model, or the grouping of homogeneous portfolios of financial instruments based on their initial credit risk. The impairment ED did not define default. However, the responses to the exposure draft highlighted the implications of not having a common understanding of what constitutes default. The ISB therefore decided to require entities to use a definition of default that is consistent with the internal definitions used for credit risk management purposes or for regulatory purposes. However, IFRS 9 also specifies that quantitative indicators of default should be considered where appropriate. And in order to ensure consistency in the way that default is interpreted, the ISB included a rebuttable presumption that default does not occur later than when financial assets are 90 days past due. The final clarification I want to highlight is the period over which expected credit losses should be measured for some financial instruments that include both a loan and an undrawn commitment component, such as credit cards and other revolving credit facilities. Although the contractual terms can generally be cancelled with only a very short notice period, such as 1 day, measuring expected credit losses over that 1 day period does not provide relevant information about the entity's expected credit losses, because in practice, these facilities are only cancelled or withdrawn when there has been an increase in credit risk that raises serious concerns about the recoverability of the outstanding amount. The ISB therefore decided to specify that for these types of financial instruments, and only these, an entity should measure expected credit losses over the period that the entity expects to be exposed to credit risk, and that expected credit losses will not be mitigated by the entity's normal credit risk management practices. In order to determine that period, an entity should consider the period over which it was exposed to credit risk on similar financial instruments, the length of time for related defaults to occur after the increase in credit risk on similar instruments, and the credit risk management actions that the entity plans to take. If we move on to disclosures, one of the most important aspects of the new impairment model is the disclosure requirements that accompany the model. Because an expected credit loss approach is very judgmental and dependent on the quality of the information an entity has available, both qualitative and quantitative disclosures are needed to help users of financial statements understand how an entity has applied the requirements, the inputs and assumptions and techniques used to measure expected credit losses, assess increases in credit risk, determine that financial instruments became credit impaired, and what the modification, write-off, and collateral policies of the entity are. In terms of the quantitative disclosure, users consistently throughout the project requested information to understand the changes in the gross carrying amount of the financial assets and the loss allowance during the period, as well as the credit risk concentrations of an entity. For this reason, the ISB requires a reconciliation of the changes in the loss allowance during the period. However, in order to fully understand the changes in the loss allowance, it is also necessary to understand the changes in the gross carrying amount of the related financial assets. Although the exposure draft required a full reconciliation of the gross carrying amount, the ISB decided, in response to the concerns raised in the comment letters, to only require quantitative disclosure of the changes in the gross carrying amount of the assets that contributed to the changes in the loss allowance. This simplification is believed to will address most of the operational concerns raised in the comment letters. With that, I will hand back over to Sue.
Thanks, Rihanna. So turning now to hedge accounting. So the objective of the new hedge accounting model in IFRS 9 is really to enable entities to better reflect their risk management activities in the financial statements, with the objective of helping investors to better understand the effect of hedging activities on the financial statements and on future cash flows. The model in IFRS 9 in particular is designed to enable entities, particularly non-financial institutions, to better apply hedge accounting to reflect their actual risk management activities. As was mentioned earlier, really the only change that's been made to the hedge accounting requirements in the latest publication of IFRS 9 is to reflect the inclusion of the fair value OCI measurement category into the hedge accounting requirements, and we haven't otherwise changed what was published in 2013. Separate to IFRS 9, we've still got an active project on accounting for macro hedging activities ongoing. We are exploring a new way to account for dynamic risk management for open portfolios of risk. We have a discussion paper at the moment open for comment. In the interim, the hedge accounting model in IFRS 9 has been designed so that entities aren't adversely affected while the new project is ongoing. Therefore, entities can continue to account for their macro hedging activities using the specific model in IAS 39 for portfolio hedges of interest rate risk, even when they use IFRS 9 for hedge accounting generally. In particular, in the case of cash flow hedge accounting, or so-called proxy hedging, it's still possible to apply that approach to hedge accounting in accordance with IFRS 9, as long as the designations reflect risk management. So in effect, the combination of the IAS 39 portfolio hedge accounting model and the use of cash flow hedge accounting, the position that already existed with IAS 39 stays in place with IFRS 9. Despite that, the ISB did, however, note that some may prefer to make no changes at all to their hedge accounting until the potential new model for accounting for macro hedging is complete. So entities can continue to make an election to continue to apply IAS 39 hedge accounting in total while otherwise applying IFRS 9 while the macro project is ongoing. Looking now at the implementation phase of IFRS 9. The mandatory effective date for IFRS 9 is the 1st of January 2018, although entities can choose to apply IFRS 9 earlier if they want to do so. Generally, if an entity decides to early apply IFRS 9, it has to apply all of the requirements, so classification and measurement, impairment, and hedge accounting, if the date of initial application is after the 1st of February 2015. However, before the 1st of January 2018, an entity can choose just to early apply the own credit requirements in IFRS 9 without having to early apply the whole standard. So in effect, that means that if an entity wants to, it can keep its financial instruments accounting unchanged, but just change the treatment of own credit. The ISB realises that in particular the new impairment model in IFRS 9 is a very significant change to accounting and has significant systems implications. And because of this, the ISB has decided to create a transition resource group that will provide support with implementation questions that arise when people start to apply IFRS 9. This will be a group that consists of subject matter experts drawing from preparers, auditors and regulatory representatives that have expertise in implementation. The group will solicit questions from stakeholders and answer questions about the implementation of the new standard in public discussions. This group won't publish its own application guidance or formal materials. Rather, if there's a need for more guidance, it will inform the ISB, who will use the normal channels of educational material, the Interpretations Committee, or in the extreme, potential changes to IFRS 9 itself to address questions that come up. As I said, all of the meetings of the transition group will be held in public, so people are able to see those discussions. Now, with that, that's the end of the formal part of the presentations, and now we'll look at answering a few questions, although not many. We try and keep these webcast short, and we've already been going for half an hour, so we'll just pick a couple of questions, and then if there's others that are of interest, we might look at putting some answers on our website to questions that are being raised. But maybe, Tenon, I'll pick on you first, and one of the questions that came up is really a general application question about the sort of concept of principal and interest in IFRS 9 and whether a zero coupon bond could be eligible for amortized cost in IFRS 9, obviously subject to business model.
Sure. Well, it is possible for a zero coupon bond to qualify. What you need to do in that case is compare the principal amount, which is essentially the amount paid by the investor or lender, to the cash inflows, the interest inflows, and see if the return is consistent with interest as described in IFRS 9.
Okay, thanks, Tiernan. Moving now to impairment for a moment, Rhianna. A question about whether even commitments to grant loans at market interest rates would be in the scope of the expected loss requirements, obviously, which would be a big change from IAS 39 thinking.
Yes, it is a big change. The impairment requirements in IFRS 9 applies to all loan commitments and financial guarantee contracts that are not measured at fair value through profit or loss. So it will apply even to commitments that were made with a market interest rate. And the reason for that is that even on those commitments, there's still exposure to credit risk, and that exposure is managed in exactly the same way as the exposure on balance sheet items or loan commitments that are at an off-market interest rate. So it applies to both at-market and off-market loan commitments.
So quite a change in the same way that market loans are in there. Staying on the subject of impairment, Tiernan, even though you didn't cover it in the slides, a question on how you determine the effective interest rate for credit-impaired financial assets under IFRS 9.
Yeah, well, this calculation is actually identical to what's currently in IAS 39. So ultimately, there's no need to adjust the contractual cash flows for the incurred losses at initial recognition. The calculation otherwise is the same as current practice.
Okay, and the scope's the same as well, isn't it? So we decided that even though it was sort of not ideal to have an incurred loss concept and an expected loss model, that the benefits of minimising systems changes were justified, so we've kept that concept in IFRS 9. Staying on impairment, Rhianna, some questions about when you determine the sort of the anchor credit quality, if you like, that you use as the base for your assessments of increases in credit risk, and whether that's the date that you commit to lend or the date that you lend money?
That really depends on the type of instrument that you have. So if you have a loan or an on-balance sheet instrument, it would be the date of initial recognition, so the date that you recognize the instrument. But if you've got a commitment, because it is off-balance sheet and you haven't recognized an asset, there's nothing to initially recognize. For the commitment, you would refer to the date that you became a party to the contract, so the date that you became committed to provide the credit under the terms in that contract.
Yes, so it depends.
Yeah.
We might just do one last question, and I'll answer this one myself, and it's one about, you know, what these sort of overall result of the changes to the solely principal and interest test is in IFRS 9 and whether that brings us back to something which is really akin to the closely related test that we had in IAS 39. It's a good question. I think that the short answer is no, because it's still looking at the sort of more economic assessment of whether the return on the instrument overall is consistent with a return on that's equivalent to principal and interest. So does it look like a return mainly for credit risk and the time value of money? But it does have a few similarities by introducing this notion of a basic lending arrangement and making it clear what wouldn't qualify for solely principal and interest. We have, for example, focused on things like having links to things like equity prices or commodity prices wouldn't be something you'd expect to see in a basic lending arrangement. So it has that flavour in it. But we still have as a main anchor this economic notion of principal and interest, which would mean that things like the double-double test in IAS 39 no longer exist. So in the extreme, in a lot of cases, the outcomes would be similar. So equity links, commodity links, etc., wouldn't be closely related, nor would they be considered solely principal and interest. But there are still some key differences, such as on the double-double test, where you'd need to do an assessment of whether it's principal and interest, and you don't get out just because it's not two times a normal interest return. That's a good question. With that, I think some of the other questions are quite specific and detailed, and they might be good ones to put onto the website with some clarifications about things like the elections for dates of initial application. So I'll wrap that webcast up now. Thanks everybody for listening. I hope this was helpful. As I said, this will be posted on our website hopefully later today, and there'll be another webcast of the same slides but with different questions this afternoon. Thanks for listening.